The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 475, recorded on August 14th, 2017. Welcome to the 475th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 308th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Jonah Falcon.
I am TJ Denzer.
And I am Scott Dirk.
VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry. So, this episode is delayed by a day. And also, I did not do a gaming flashback or gaming history because things are sort of last minute, kind of, sort of. We will discuss something that was in the news last week, and I think you all know what it is. Jim Sterling going off on a game, giving it a 1 out of 10, because he encountered a game-stopping bug. And then later that night, he had to apologize, and basically for just going off the handle.
Yeah. Are you talking about Hellblade? So,
I haven't seen this. I didn't know.
Well, last week, Jim encountered a bug. And it has something to do with the way the game autosaves. That if you do not grab a torch for a certain area, you'll get killed because it's dark. Unfortunately, the way the game autosaves, it autosaves after you enter the area. So if you did not enter with the torch, you're stuck in there without the torch, and you'll get killed over and over and over again.
This is why we need multiple saves, so you can go back. It's been a real issue with me.
I think it does have, but maybe it sends you so far back, like Lost Planet. If you get killed in Lost Planet, the checkpoint is sometimes 20 minutes ago, you know, that sort of thing. But it wasn't so much the fact that he encountered this bug, and a few other people did, but a lot of people completed the game. It's just that he went on a tirade, and basically, the best you could say, it was a temper tantrum. And he had to sheepishly make a video basically apologizing for it.
Yeah, I mean,
I think it would be, this would be solved by, like I said, like in Skyrim, I can have multiple saves and I manually save them, and I'll have like 500 saves per character, you know, for example. If you allow a player to have that ability, then they probably won't get so screwed over by this kind of thing that they go on a tirade. I mean, the guy rarely,
he goes on tirades.
Yeah, and I was going to speak to it from the perspective of a reviewer. I know that Jim Sterling has a certain persona about him. I know that when he gets riled up about a game, that's kind of what sells. But I think it was a snap decision on his part. I think from everyone that I've spoken to, and there are a lot of divided critics on certain parts of Hellblade, but generally speaking, everyone I've talked to has spoken to it as like an 8 or a 9, a pretty good game from a pretty good company. Ninja Theory does some pretty good stuff. They did Enslaved, Journey to the West. They did Heaven's Blade, which not as many people like, but it's still pretty good. But this was a situation where, like, if I ran into a bug like that, I would probably be pretty pissed too. At the same time, I wonder, I would probably take points off of the game for such a bug, but I don't know if the rest of the experience was good. I don't know that would be enough for me to knock a game down from an 8 or a 9 to a 1.
Now, I can speak to a current situation because my situation is very parallel. So here's what's going on with me. I am trying to play Batman Telltale Series Season 2, Episode 1. However, for whatever reason, my version, which is the Xbox One version, it does not respond to controls correctly. It does, you know, and at a point early in the game, it will not register at all the left trigger plus A. And if I reboot it, it's stuck in that spot. So I boot it, right trigger plus A. I cannot finish the game. I can't even finish the first part of the game. But here's where I differ from what Jim is doing. See, when I have something like this, and it's happened once or twice before, I contact a developer. I contacted Telltale and told them, listen, I cannot continue on this part of the game because I'm because I'm blocked by it. They suggest it can use a keyboard. I say no, because even though I can use the Xbox One with a keyboard, it's not registering anyway. So right now I'm talking to Telltale. I have to wonder, did Jim ever contact Ninja Theory and say, this is what's going on? You know? And even so, I know people have completed the game, you know? And you'll see other people who have completed the game once, twice, three times. So it's not like this is a problem for everybody. You know, sometimes the problem is with you and just you and maybe a few other people.
Like, yeah, I mean, clearly that is a bug, but that's something that can be fixed. The point being, if you were having fun up until that point, is it really worth like tearing the entire thing apart? It feels like, I don't know.
If it was a bad game, you'd probably be you'd probably be happy that you can't play it anymore if it was a bad game.
if I was so off the top of my head, I think the one game that I've ever given a 2, and it wasn't even called Resident Evil. It was Umbrella Corps.
Umbrella Corps, yes, that thing.
which was the ill-fated 3v3 shooter that Capcom came out with, where you play as umbrella soldiers fighting on a battlefield with zombies around. And it was basically unplayable. The frame rate was janky. The zombies were useless.
We're talking about the PC version here, because the PC version was especially bad.
The way to keep safe from the zombies was particularly stupid, because it was a little remote control on your neck. And if you got shot in that thing, the zombies would attack you. But at the same time, that's basically the same as getting a headshot anyway. So, like, what's the point? And, like, from the bottom to the top, that game, like, I fought to play it because I was doing it for a job. It was my job to play the game, and I had to sit down and figure out what is this about and what does it offer. And it was so damn hard to just get the game to play properly. That's what I give a 2.
I'll tell you a game that I gave a 1.5 out of 5 to, and I caught hell for it, but I still stand by that review even today.
And
that was the first Max Payne for GamePen.
Oh, damn. Why'd you give it a 1.5?
Well, it's very easy. I mean, it had the one gimmick, the bullet time. And the first level was interesting. It took place in a subway. But after that, it was the same place over and over and over again. Dirty building, bad AI, awful writing. And, you know, aside from the bullet time, the graphics weren't that great. You know, it seemed to me like they finished the first level and then quickly cut and paste the rest of the levels together. It was just such a slog to play. And it didn't help that the character of Max Payne was a screen capture of the developer himself. And if you ever saw that Max Payne, it looked like he was smelling his own fart during the entire game.
Yeah, he had a really funky face on, and it was kind of funny.
But the thing is that the game lived and died on its one gimmick. And I said, okay, it's a gimmick. It's bullet time. Okay. I guarantee if you try and play it now, the gameplay does not hold up. But, you know, a lot of reviewers are like that, because Tom Chick gave Deus Ex a negative review, and he still stands by that review. And I can see where he's coming, you know, from certain parts of Deus Ex from the technical level. I mean, it wasn't a very advanced game. Most of the game came from the story and the decisions you made, you know. The actual shooter part of it was, it was more of a role-playing game than it was a shooter.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a little tougher to play, but I still enjoy it.
Yeah. And I think that is the perspective of just different reviewers. You find the ones that you trust, and you and you listen to them the most. I mean, clearly Jim Sterling has gained himself a presence for what he has in his reviews in the past. And I think the fact that he had to walk back this one just is a fact that him as a professional realized he made a snap decision and didn't necessarily agree with it after he cooled down.
But here's the problem. A lot of developers and publishers will look at him side-eyed at that. You know, here's the thing. This is a very small industry, and you live and die with the relationships you have with other, you know, with other people in the industry. Derek Smart did himself no favors by being so mercurial and angry at everything, and, you know, because, you know, they might have passed it off, well, you know, it was a nice attempt, you know, but it's not a very good game. Derek Smart took it personally and just went after everybody, and he's basically a non-entity right now. I've spoken to him, and he will get mercurial, and it's sort of like, I'm on your side. What are you doing? You know?
Yeah, and I mean, like, that's another thing about Jim Sterling, though, is, like, he edits his own stuff, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I would assume so.
The other thing is that he doesn't care about web hits, and he doesn't care about YouTube hits because he's entirely Patreon-funded.
See, but the point I was going to make, though, is that people like you and I, when we were writing about this stuff, we have editors. We have people that are going to talk to us and say, is that true? Is that what you thought about it?
I am an editor, so...
We have people that are going to talk to us about this stuff and ask us questions when they see something that's like, especially something that doesn't seem to like fit with what's going out there, and especially something that doesn't seem to fit like what's going on.
Now, here's the thing,
and,
you know,
and if we stand by it, then we stand by it. But I think Jim Sterling doesn't benefit from not having someone to like talk to him and tell him, "Are you sure about that?"
Well, he did write for Destructoid at one point. Remember. I was about to say something, and I know I forgot. yeah. And he also wrote, you know, he was weighing in on the microtransactions in Shadow of War, which I have zero problem with, because here's the thing. It's not a paywall, and they're not hiding it, and everything you can get with real money, you can get with in-game money, and it's sort of like Garden Warfare 2. If you ever played that, you know, you buy these... card packs with money that you earn in the game, and you can get 20,000 coins if you play hard for a day, and it only costs 80,000 coins to buy an entire character if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've never really felt the need to have to buy, you know, coins. And someone else said something that was very interesting, in that microtransactions now are what cheat codes were. Because if you wanted a big head... remember the big head mode in a lot of games like Grand Theft Auto 3? Well, in those days, you put in a team code. These days, you'd pay $1.99 to get that mode. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, you know, he does research, so it isn't like he's always talking out of his ass. You know, a review is something different. A review is your experience, and you're writing it down on a piece of paper, you know. Because Jim has lawyers, so when he talks about stuff like Digital Foundry, he's not going off, you know, he may go off verbally, you know, and do cluster F-bombs, but he's not doing it from a purely emotional standpoint. He knows exactly what the laws are, you know, and he uses that personality to get across to people who are equally mercurial, look, we're not going to let you do this. And here's the other thing, Jim, by the way, Jim Sterling is not his real name. His real name is James. In person, he is extremely quiet. He's almost agoraphobic, and he has anxiety around people. So the Jim Sterling you see on YouTube is a character.
Right. But that's what I'm saying, is that it's a successful character, and there's certainly a level of like fame to him and reaction out of getting that stuff out fast and getting it out efficiently.
You know, that entire thank God for me, that's something he didn't really want to do, but he found that people really responded to it. So he's okay. I'm just going to up the 11 on what people think I'm like.
Yeah, and when that becomes your persona, and at the same time, when you're editing yourself, there's a certain area where, like, it becomes a little bit more difficult to walk yourself back from something you're doing. I feel like when I've written stuff myself with little editing to it, I came back to that and read it, and there have been things in there that I didn't necessarily agree with a few, like maybe a month or two after I wrote it. And I
the other thing is that, do you remember the Jeff Grossman GameStop, the Jeff Grossman GameSpot controversy with Kanan Lynch? And it was pulled down, presumably because it had a 6.0 score, which I don't think is really all that bad, you know, but there was heavy advertising on the site for it. As an editor, mm-hmm. I wasn't immediately ready to believe it was because it was a low score. The thing is, yeah, you can have a low score, but how did you say it? There's many ways to give a negative review. And going off and making outrageous stuff, that's going to get your article pulled. Even if it's a positive review, it's going to get it pulled. I had to wait until the actual information was out. And, yeah, it was because, you know, GameSpot was pressured by Square Enix. Was it Square Enix who published it? I think it was Square Enix. But I wasn't ready to jump on board with they did it because it was a low score. You know, sometimes I think, well, it could have been because of many other reasons that had nothing to do with the score.
Yeah. I respect Jim for being able to pull that back, though. Well, I mean, obviously, there is some level of damage done, but, like, being able to look at something that you created, and obviously something that you spent time on, like he does, being able to look at that and say, well, this isn't actually probably true.
When you give a good review for a game that everybody likes, that's the hardest thing in the world to do. Because everybody looks at you like saying, why aren't you marching step with everybody else? You know, I mean, in this case, Jim said he was enjoying himself, so it wasn't like it was a one. He thought it was a one. He said he thought it was a 7 or an 8, but gave it a 1 because he got so frustrated, you know.
Yeah, it was a snap decision. And like I said, editor, friends, walking away from the project for a bit, those are kind of things that you need to do sometimes.
The other thing is that I think there's also a pressure to get your review out fast. You know,
absolutely.
You don't want to have to go to Ninja Theory and say, I'm having a problem with the game, and this is the problem, and wait for them to help you fix it. Because he said, I don't want to wait until it's patched. The problem is that everybody else was having no problems because there was a very specific bug that you had to do something specifically to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and like I said, you know, you really save points. If you're going to go with checkpoints, you better make them good. And that, I mean, if he had said, well, I would have given it an 8, but I'll give it a 7 because it had this bug, everybody said, oh, okay.
Yeah. That would be a reasonable response. But he was angry, and I understand that. I've been angry at a video game several times.
So how about you, Scott? Have you ever – not that – well, actually, you have – well, you haven't reviewed a game, but you have had copies that, you know – that you were got incredibly frustrated by and had to wait for tech support to help you?
I think the only time that I had a game where I couldn't proceed further because of a bug, it would have to be Quest for Glory 4. And that was, the famous Error 52 where you slid down, this, like, slope. And see, the thing is, you have to even go back further because this game came out just as like a new processor for the PCs came out, and so this game was made for the previous generation of processor. So when you played it on the newer one, the clocking speed was out of sync, and that would cause the error 52 in this game in this particular moment. Because you were supposed to slide down at a certain speed, at a certain rate, and the computer was trying to make it go faster, and it couldn't, and so it would crash. And that was really the last game-stopping bug that I can really remember that was frustrating. I mean, I did get Skyrim to crash, but I stopped a script from executing, and that was General Tullius or whatever. He was giving his speech that killed him before he could finish it, and that caused the game to crash. But I figured that was my fault. That was all on me.
You know, it reminds me. I actually played one of the Batman. I don't know if it was Arkham Asylum. I think it was Arkham City. And there was this game. There was this part in which you had it just wouldn't register, so you couldn't do the mission. Fortunately, it was a side quest, so you didn't really have to worry about it. The most irritating thing is not when it's on a PC, because a PC, you can say, oh, well, you know, every PC is different, so there's going to be bugs because everybody has a different system. But when it happens on a console system, like Jim did with the PS4 and I did with the Xbox One, it's especially annoying because everybody has the same rig.
Yeah, that is... That's a lot of the reason why you see, like, I mean, that's one of the reasons why we have to put up which system we're playing, outside of the fact that it's just helpful to have that information.
I mean, Scott, you know this. I mean, you're playing on a PC game. It's like, well, hopefully I have the right graphic card. Hopefully I have the right processor. Hopefully I have the right memory. Hopefully I have the right RAM. Hopefully, you know, and it's like any number of things can say, well, you know, on a Radeon card, you're going to have these problems.
And obviously people who played the PS4 version of Batman Arkham Knight and people who played the PC version had very different experiences. Just because that game was not optimized for PC at all. It was horribly misaligned when it came to a lot of the graphical issues. And that's the kind of thing that, like, we have to be transparent about what we're playing on, because it's not going to be the same sometimes.
Scott, you ever have to worry about looking at the tech specs and saying, oh, this might be a problem?
Yeah, I always check the tech specs. Lately, my computer has seemed to have been able to play any game that I want, so I haven't had too many issues. Because I generally don't play first-person shooter games, and those seem to be some of the more demanding ones. So I think I've been pretty lucky. I play mostly the isometric games, as you know, and most of them have pretty
low system requirements.
Not very demanding.
Yeah, but I remember one of the Civs had the crash bug that was really annoying. And it's like, oh, come on. I think it was the one after Civ 4, the Gods one. Was it Gods? What was it called again? The one that added religion to Civ 4?
That was Civ 4.
Not Brave New World, it was the one before it. Anyway, that one had a bug that crashed people's things. And you always have these updates saying, it'll do this, you know. So anyways, so what have you been playing, Scott?
Mostly a little bit of Minecraft. The episode 2 of season 2 hasn't come out yet. I only played the first one.
It did come out. Episode 2 of Minecraft Telltale series has come out. I got the...
Until tomorrow.
Oh. Well, I know I got the press release for it.
Yeah, you must have. I don't get it until tomorrow, so I haven't played it. But I kept checking until I found out that it was coming out tomorrow, so I will play it when it comes out.
How about you, TJ?
So I've been playing Pyre by Supergiant Games, who created Transistor and Bastion. And I've been having a fantastic time with it. It's almost like an RPG mixed with a sort of sport game, like its own sort of creative sport game, where you've got three characters on each team, and the point is you have to steal this orb from the center and run it over to your enemy's like central point, which is a pyre of fire, and throw it in there to knock health off of it.
Yeah, and you also, it's sort of Dota-ish in that you can assign traits to each character.
Each character is a very different kind of character. Like, there's a literal little bat, although it's called an imp, that can jump into the air and flutter around. And when he's on the ground, he can explode and take out all the characters around him. And by the way, like, every character has a certain aura, and if and it wraps around them in a circle when they're not holding the orb. So if any other character approaches them, they explode and have to respawn after a few seconds.
Yeah, you forgot to mention the bat has a handlebar mustache.
Oh, yeah, I love him too. In fact, I loved. Actually, no, you're thinking of another character, Rookie. Rookie, there's all sorts of interesting characters. One of them is Rookie, who's like a they're this race of dog-like talking humanoid things that are called Kurs, and there's just a lot of different like fun character styles and variations.
Yeah, we have to mention that their full characters are very anime-esque.
Yeah, it has that. Supergiant Games, if you've played them, if you've played Bastion, and if you've played Transistor, then you have to know that they have a very distinct type of art style for their type of games. And they obviously went like sort of Zelda-ish for Bastion. They went cyberpunk for Transistor. And this time around, they just went straight up fantasy fiction. And it's really cool just to see the way they illustrate characters and worlds and bring these diverse sort of voices together into your party. I'm really having fun with it.
Also, Rikiman, a lot of the worlds have a very hand-painted look to them. Pyre. It's on Steam.
P-Y-R-E.
Yeah, it's on Steam. It's only $20, too.
Yeah. Supergiant doesn't make bad games that I know of, and this one is coming out to be like just as fun as Bastion and Transistor. I'm going to get a lot out of it. And
I also heard the soundtrack is incredible, too.
Dynamite soundtrack. I love them. Like, I still use Transistor as my PS4 theme because the music in Transistor was super haunting and super, like, you could just zone out to it. It made perfect background noise. And Pyre is the same. They've got a very distinct sort of just like low tempo guitar feel to them. Lots of just like gentle sweeping tunes. And then in the actual matches, it gets really intense and tight when it needs to be.
Yeah, I also have to mention that not only does it have a single player mode, but it has one of those rare things on PC, and that is local multiplayer, same machine game, what's it called, play, which you seldom ever see on PCs anymore.
Yeah, and that's a really cool thing about it, because there's all sorts of, like I said, you assemble a team of three, and there are much more than three characters that you get, so there's a lot of different compositions you can do for your teams, and it's really cool to see, like, me and my wife have played a few games, and it's really fun to see, like, what compositions work best against what teams.
Okay, nothing else?
Nope, that's it.
Okay. I've been trying to play Batman, as I mentioned before. We still haven't solved the problem. And here's the thing, by the way, it's worse to give no review than a low review, because, you know, they want stuff for you. If they know that you're probably going to like it, they want to hear quotes from you. So I started playing XCOM 2 again, because I'm, you know, now they have the Steam page for the upcoming expansion, and it sort of, you know, sort of whet my appetite for XCOM, so I'm playing that. And I will say this, the expansion is not a small one. It's going to cost $40. And I've been playing Bayonetta again, and enjoying it. I'm finding that there seems to be a delay in the port in the controller, at least where buttons are concerned, because it used to be, I used to get those megatons really easily, and now it's just sort of like a lag there. And now I have to be careful about doing the dodge rolls. I'm finding I have to do the dodge roll really quickly to get witch time. So there's an adjustment. I mean, not all backwards compatible is smooth. Some of them, there is a toll that's taken. I will say this, you know, I'm looking forward to when original Xbox backwards compatibility is up, because I want to play some KOTOR again. And I want to see if the DLC, the one DLC, the Yavin Station DLC for KOTOR, because I couldn't get it to work on the Xbox 360. So I'm hoping I'll be able to get it to work on the Xbox One. Not that it's a big deal. Yavin Station was basically a store for some unique stuff, but still, I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Anyways, we don't have any gaming history, like I said, or game flashback, but we do have a lot of news, and I'm going to take off the first one. I'm going to take on the first one. EA talks about Nintendo Switch support, and this comes from GameSpot. Gaming publisher giant EA is banging FIFA 18, that would be embarrassing, to the Nintendo Switch. But what about other titles? Worldwide Studios VP Patrick Söderlund said in a new interview that while he is personally excited over the Nintendo and the Switch, it's too soon to say whether or not EA will release more of its games or build new ones for the hybrid console. According to a Nintendo insider, Söderlund said that in the latest issue of Edge magazine, quote, "I'm a gigantic Nintendo fanboy, and he takes the Switch everywhere." EA is taking a platform-agnostic approach, as many publishers do. If there's a business opportunity, EA will bring its games to any platforms it seems, including Switch. Söderlund said, "We believe in any platform where there are consumers. We believe that we want to be part of the Switch and help Nintendo grow that install base. That's why you see FIFA, which, by the way, is really good this year. It's a full-fledged FIFA game, and for the first time, to be honest, on a portable device." Söderlund went on to mention that EA had to consider the amount of resources it puts into anything as part of running a business because, quote-unquote, the numbers become a factor. The executive teased that EA may be bringing other games beyond FIFA 18 to the Switch, and if these titles are successful, then more could come later. He added, "So, for us, it's about supporting the platform, building technology on the platform, testing out big things like FIFA, and maybe a couple of others, we'll see. And if they go well, I see no reason why we shouldn't have as much of our portfolio on that platform as possible. I hope we get there. That would be my personal ambition." FIFA 18 for Switch does not run on the Frostbite engine, nor does it have the game's The Journey mode, which is the career mode. I found it interesting that he called the Switch a portable device.
Yeah, I mean, it still is. It's not the most practical portable device, I would say, but it does create certain challenges for being able to bring certain games over that you would also put on PS4 and Xbox One, because clearly the Switch is not a workhorse that those other systems are.
Yeah, well, the FIFA 18 is apparently something that they built without using their proprietary engine, and it's lacking features. But on the other hand, soccer is major, and EA always makes money with FIFA, big time.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, after the rift that Nintendo and EA had for the longest time, I think it points to something that EA and Nintendo are willing to work on anything and collaborate on anything again. I mean, we've talked about it on this podcast before. There was a long period of time where EA had wanted nothing to do with Nintendo because of Nintendo's oppressive third party what's the word for it?
Licensing.
Yes, we'll just go with that.
It's, you know, I'm wondering, does that mean you're going to see Unravel on the Switch? I think it would be pretty obvious choice to make.
When I think of games that I would want to see on the Switch, I think, can it be done easily? Like, not can it be done easily, but is it the sort of thing that I worry about performance or graphical integrity that much?
You know, and I'm thinking that. Here's the thing. Why not games like Tyranny or Baldur's Gate or, you know, all these isometric RPGs aren't that resource intensive. I think they would be a natural to be on the Switch.
That and also games that I would want to play for hours on end, not necessarily on my TV. Pick up the screen and take it places. Or like Sonic Mania is coming out tomorrow, and it's on PS4 and Switch, but I think that's one of the ones I'm going to get on the Switch because the idea of playing Sonic Mania wherever I feel like it is something I haven't been able to do since Game Gear.
And, those, you know, a lot of Steam games are making their way to the Switch. And I think part of it is because a lot of them are not very resource intensive. And also they have that, you know, that play and go sort of feel to it.
Yeah. Binding of Isaac Rebirth found new life on the Switch. And it's like a perfect fit for that. Just, I mean, it's not a perfect fit for Nintendo. It's a little less wholesome than their general.
Nintendo put Bayonetta on the Wii U. Okay. Let's not talk about wholesome here.
But yeah, I would like to see things like Unravel. I would like to see I think that Tyranny would be a great fit because you could totally take advantage of the Switch's touchscreen interface. There is a touchscreen to that, and you can fiddle with it.
How about you, Scott? If you're going to get a Switch, what games would you like to see on it? Aside from the ones it's already getting, like Zelda and Splatoon.
Well, I'd like to see more RPGs, maybe some puzzle games. I'm not really interested in the sports stuff, but I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't mind the racing games, but got Mario Kart, I guess, for that.
Let's interpret that as, yes, I want Professor Layton on the Switch.
Yeah. Definitely. Yes. Yeah, and like I said, adventure games like Zelda or, you know, side-scrolling Metroidvania-like games, those are always good. You know, just maybe some RPGs. It just would be, yeah, I guess, like you said, the Baldur's Gate. But not that other console Baldur's Gate that they had. That was terrible. They basically made it like Diablo or something.
Well, you know, Level 5 has been talking about bringing Professor Layton and Ni No Kuni to the Switch.
I would love to see Ni No Kuni on the Switch. That would be really fun.
Oh, yeah, Ni No Kuni. Yeah, but I think that's going to be on PlayStation only right now. But yeah, games like Ni No Kuni would be great.
You know what would be nice? If they had a greatest, you know, a Layton bundle. It doesn't have to be the latest one with Lady Layton. Just the first, what is it, three? Were the three Layton games released?
Six.
Six.
Six Layton games.
Yeah. I mean, I played the first one on the 3DS. I never the first one and the second one, and I didn't play after that because they also had that crossover between Professor Layton and Phoenix Wright.
Well, they had two trilogies basically. They had, well, I guess it's like Star Wars. Only the prequel is really good, and in Layton you had the main story, and then you had a prequel story. And the prequel story was done afterwards, and it started getting into character animations, and they would move around and talk and voice acting, and it was really it got more focused on the story, and maybe a little bit less on the puzzles. They still had a lot of puzzles, but it felt like it was focusing more on the story.
Well, there's a reason for that. There's just so many versions of a puzzle that you can do before people start getting bored of it.
Your lack of imagination is astounding.
Your lack of imagination disturbs me.
I want to say this quote because I played the games. I played the first trilogy, but I played the second one of it, and then the third one, and then I played the prequel. And after the huge finale of the prequel, I go to the first game, and it's really amazing because they have this quote in the very beginning. Where the boy is like, Professor, we've already done this, you know, what makes this, you know, interesting or different from our last adventure? And he's like, this is an altogether unique and different experience, and it will be exciting to see what unfolds. So it's like, even though you just had this epic adventure, there's always a new one ahead. You know, there's always a new thing. And I just loved that optimism that was in that message.
I also think that it helps that they, like, yes, there are some types of puzzles that sort of they retread, like the moving shapes puzzles. Mm-hmm. However, they do have a dude that, like, he's basically a professor, a professor of literally just making puzzles up. And the guy comes up with some pretty elaborate stuff. Like,
yeah.
Some of them, like, look like they could be considered similar, but they're presented in such different ways that creates a different solution that it's engaging and doesn't feel like you're retreading the same ground. Don't get me wrong. I don't like the sliding shapes puzzles that much because I feel like they're the laziest variation of a Layton puzzle. But there are like over 100 puzzles in each game. So
yeah.
I think that retread is just bound to happen at certain points.
Well, fortunately, Professor Layton himself is interesting enough that, you know...
Yes. The whole story is really good, I think.
I mean, actually, in the first one, and here goes a spoiler, folks. First quarter of the game is like, oh no, they can't be honestly going to go with the idea that everybody in town is a robot. And then, oh, they're not going with that. And then, oh, guess what? Everybody in town is a robot. Which is why they're all so puzzle-obsessed. So for those who haven't played the first Professor Layton game, for spoiling, but, you know, the first one came out in, what, 2000? Something like that? I don't know.
Yeah, it was 2007.
Right. Wow, 10 years. Oh, I thought it was older than that. Oh, that's right. It couldn't have been on the DS in 2000.
Yeah, they do have a reason why everybody's a robot.
In that episode, yeah. I mean, just it's like there is a very good reason. I was just like, it's like they're hinting around. Oh, okay. Anyway, we're gonna move on to the next anime. Go ahead, TJ.
Alrighty, Rainbow Six Siege Operation Blood Orchid updates launch. Sorry. Rainbow Six Siege Operation Blood Orchid update launches August 29th from IGN. Rainbow Six Siege's latest update, Operation Blood Orchid, will be released on August 29th for PlayStation 4, PC, and Xbox One. According to Ubisoft, Operation Blood Orchid features a new map set in Hong Kong, several new customization items, and three new operators. While the map will be free to all players as of August 29, the three new operators will only be available to season pass holders on that date. Everyone else will be able to purchase the operators on September 5th. Ubisoft will share more details about Operation Blood Orchid during its live stream at Gamescom on August 26. Rainbow Six Siege's roadmap was recently revised to help fix a few technical issues. Also, the game just hit 20 million registered players last week, which is fantastic. I mean, it couldn't have even been over 1 million when I started, and now it's over 20 million. That's great.
So, do you know the three new operators?
I don't. I haven't seen anything on them yet. I don't know if they've... Yeah, I don't know anything about them yet. However, I do know that that's different than... This is a little bit different than what they've done with DLCs in the past. Generally speaking, the rule of thumb with DLCs in the past was that it was just going to be one attacking operator and one defending operator. So I'm curious as to why they went with three this time.
Maybe one does both, or maybe does neither.
Either that, or they could be some... One thing I've been starting to see in MOBAs, and I'm not saying that...
Uber oh, you're going to talk about a dual-controlled one?
I was going to say something along those lines. Heroes of the Storm had a dual-controlled character. League of Legends put out two characters that worked better when they were with each other on the team, as opposed to just using one by itself. And so I'm a little curious to see if Ubisoft is going to play around with that idea of making a set of operators that might gain an extra benefit from both being on the same team.
Okay. So we'll move on to the next item. Go ahead, Scott.
Okay. Rainbow Siege 6 Operation...
No, that was... He just did that.
Myth-inspired RTS Deadhole charges into early access later this month. This is from PC Gamer. If you loved Bungie's Myth games from the 90s and early 2000s, think combat-focused strategy with no base building... then you're probably going to enjoy Deadhold, a tactical RTS that charges into early access later this month. Inspired by the Myth titles, the units you start a match with are the only ones you can use. The emphasis is on maneuvering small groups or even individual units into the right position and then micromanaging them to avoid oncoming attacks. The combat is physically modeled, so arrows will embed into a specific part of a unit, their head or arm, and they'll react accordingly. The bombs thrown by range sapper can dismember your enemies, painting the ground red, and the line shield-wielding warriors can act as physical barrier to stop the progression of other team. You and up to three friends can fight through a story-driven campaign, or you can pit your skills against up to eight players in competitive multiplayer. The early access version releases on August 25th. It comprises the first segment of the campaign, one single-player Horde mode map, and parts of the competitive multiplayer mode. More campaign missions and Horde maps will be added as and when they are finished. As you go through matches, you'll pick up loot and level your units.
So if you ever played Myth, think of an RTS, except the characters are huge, and you're basically just sending, like, a group of 12 people or splitting them up, you know, and it's, like, very on-ground level. So it's not like an RTS where you're putting all these massive troops and all that. No. You're micromanaging each and every character and each and every soldier. If you lose one, then it's a big blow because everything is very ground level. Everything is, like, when they fight, it's sort of like watching... You've seen For Honor, right? Well, this is basically the RTS version of For Honor. I'll just leave it at that. Mm-mm. And it's been a while since we've had a Myth-type game. I mean, like I said, you don't have any base building. You get troops, and then you say, okay, they're the other guys. It's up to you to defeat them with these people and these people alone.
It reminds me of, I can't remember which one it was. There was another RTS that's like a World War II style RTS where you command like a squad of troops as opposed to like an actual army.
Company of Heroes? Each of them
might be, yeah, Company of Heroes. It makes me think of that.
But this one's even more, what's it called, to ground level, in which you're just dealing with a couple of guys, 10 guys. It's, like I said, it's a tactical strategy, and you really have to do the strategy. You know, because one wrong move, and you can get 5 guys wiped out, and you might as well just start over, because just picture you moving characters along the ground. Like I said, it's a different type of RTS. I hesitate to even call it an RTS. They didn't call it an RTS in the day, even though it was technically an RTS.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, this one is going to be very interesting to watch. I mean, there are a lot of properties that Bungie had that no one's done anything with, like Myth, and especially Oni. Have you ever played Oni?
Yes.
That was an incredible game. I didn't like it because it was very ruthless. The game would just... Sorry, you died. You didn't see that sniper from 5 miles away? Well, too bad. You died. Start over.
We're talking about the. It was sort of anime-ish.
It was anime, yeah. It was sort of like a combination third-person shooter and fighting game, because when you got in close, then you started going into fighter controls. You know, you had to do all this martial arts to disarm people. But yeah, there were people with sniper rifles, and if you got in their sights, you were as good as dead.
Yeah, this came from a time when people were still super, super high on Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah,
and.
It's one of the games I just, you know, said, screw it, here's the God mode. I just want to enjoy the story. And I love the two endings. There's one ending in which you can either shoot your commanding officer or spare him. And I always love to spare him because she gave this withering reason you suck speech to him, saying that she would never be a tool for anybody, and how dare you, and you know what, I'm not even going to kill you because you're not worth it, so just get out of my sight. And the best part of doing that was when the final boss appears, the guy you just told off, the commander, comes to your rescue.
Yeah, that was an interesting game, and I don't know how that would do if it came out today.
Oh, I think it would be a smash. There's no games that are like it right now. Nothing. Scott, I'll describe it to you. Imagine being able to do a fighting game, except it's an RPG, and you level up, and you can run around, and you also can, you know, and also it has a great story. Although I will say it does veer into Akira a bit too much at times, as well as Ghost in the Shell.
River City Ransom, you could level up, and there was a story, and you were fighting.
Yeah, this one was more polygonal in that it was a fully 3D game.
I mean, it sounds cool.
I'll tell you what, you know what you should do? Just look at the trailer for Oni, or even just, you know, gameplay. I mean, there's nothing like it. And there was nothing like Myth, getting back to this game. So it'll be interesting to see how this one does. Because this one's a little bit more of a risk, because, you know, it's an RTS, but it's very, very tactical. Extremely tactical. To the point in which you have individual people that you're dealing with, not units.
Yeah. I haven't played it, but it sounds interesting. And Deadhold, I mean, I would be willing to look it up and give it at least a good look, because I do love a good RTS, and I do like things that make you actually consider how you use your units rather than just throwing all of them into the meat grinder until you eventually break through.
I really hope they have a demo, because here's the thing. Myth had a demo and it sold a lot of people on it, you know, and demos are a lot rarer these days. And I think, and the reason, you know, demos are very hard to make. People think, oh, you're just cutting part of, no, that's not how a demo works. Demo, you develop a demo separately from the main game. You know, you may be using the same assets, but a demo requires its own development. But I do hope they have a demo for this.
It's like when you develop the first level of Max Payne and put that out, and then you make the rest of the game.
Anyway, we're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, TJ.
Alrighty. No Man's Sky Atlas update adds 30 hours of new story content and limited online co-op from PC Gamer. Just over 12 months since launch, No Man's Sky awaits its imminent Atlas Rises update, which has come out by this time, and Hello Games has now announced what we can expect. According to the developer, there is 30 hours of new story content, which includes the appearance of a new, mysterious interdimensional alien race, alongside limited online co-op. The latter, or lack thereof, created a stir at launch, so it'll be interesting to see what's on offer. Here's the heading, Joint Exploration. Under the heading, Joint Exploration, here's the skinny from Hello Games. Quote, glitches in the simulation have begun to appear. Visualized by strange floating orbs, up to 16 players can see and communicate with one another and explore the universe together. While interaction with others is currently very limited, this is an important first step into the world of synchronous co-op in No Man's Sky. While interaction is very limited, voice over IP allows proximity-based voice chat with other nearby explorers. Use portals to quickly travel to more populated planets or to meet up with friends. Atlas Rises also promises to improve mapping and waypointing, as well as an overhaul to the game's trading system. The update also targets an expected amount of quality of life, texture, and visual improvements, while terrain editing looks particularly interesting. And all I have to say to all of this is that if there's still an AI that chimes in every 5 seconds to let me know if I need a resource or if the planet sucks or if
anything else going on? It's sort of like, congratulations, you've walked 20,000 miles. Congratulations, you have been zapped by 50,000 volts of radiation. Congratulations, you've died 5,000 times because the notice here is blocking off your controls and you can't really see what you're doing. Congratulations.
I mean, I can only hear oxygen levels running low and carbon levels running low so many times before I just start to lose my mind.
Or it reminds you that you can press A to lift off, even though you've been doing it 50 times during the game.
I love the idea that they're adding new stuff to this, and I think that people that are giving this a chance and going to jump in there after so long, I think they'll have a good time.
Well, if you already bought the game, you really don't have a choice in the matter. You might as well check out what the update gives. By the way, for those who don't know, this is a free update. This is not an expansion or anything. This is basically an overhaul of the game.
Oh, Jonah, I have the game and I have a choice.
You don't want to be bored again? Is that? Yeah, the real question of the update, did you take out the monotony, is what they want to know.
That's what I would say. Like, unless there's an option end game that allows me to turn off notifications, then I'm not willing to sit in for 30 more hours of oxygen levels depleting, carbon levels depleting.
Well, here's the thing. At least
you need more platinum.
Well, the story content sounds like it sounds like to me, I don't know if it's true, sounds like it's a more linear storyline that you can follow, you know, other than you make your own adventure. Going on 50 quintillion planets that are all just different palette swaps.
What were you going to say, Scott?
Scott, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, go ahead.
I don't really have anything to add. I haven't really played this game. I've had no interest in it. It's bad launch, basically. Definitely turned me off from even considering this game. I watched some Let's Plays, and I hope that this bring some new entertainment to any of the people that are still playing it. But this really, I mean, I think this is one of those things that Paul likes to say, as a bad game lasts forever, and No Man's Sky has now earned its reputation of being a bad game, and I don't know if there's anything that can really take that away.
You know, I played No Man's Sky 12 years ago when it was called Spore, and here's the thing, yeah, Spore had more variety.
Spore was so disappointing. It was immensely disappointing. It fell so short of what it had promised. It just felt like it did feel like this was misleading. This was not what you promised me. I thought I was going to get this epic, you know, epic story of raising a biological specimen from single cell to reach it to the stars, and all I got was this like fast forward, I don't know, 12 second. It goes so quickly, and it just does not feel as in depth as I thought it was going to be.
No. You know, I can do an entire gaming history on the development of Spore, because and one of the funniest parts was that EA had nothing to do with it, with the failures of the game. It was all internal, and it was a fight between Will Wright and Chris Hecker, who later become famous for saying that the Wii was two GameCubes duct taped together. And a lot of it was science versus what was the word they used? Science versus cute. No, yeah. And the cute side won. Yeah. Because if you remember the early videos of Spore, remember how when your creature killed something, it grabbed it, and then you could have it drag the corpse to eat on the beach? The most disappointing thing was that all the creatures that I created, their skeletons felt like they were made of jello. If you created a long-limbed, giraffe-like creature, it walked like something from a 30s cartoon.
It was just so disappointing.
Yeah. Although I will say, I got a little mild thrill when I went to a planet and all of a sudden the music from Mule started playing. Oh, I'm from the 80s so much. Mule, if you don't know what Mule is, it's a 1983 game. Just check it out. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, Scott.
EA says Star Wars Battlefront lacked long-term goals. One of the year's most anticipated games... Oh, yeah, sorry. This is from GameSpot. Sorry about that. One of this year's most anticipated games, Star Wars Battlefront 2, is already looking to be a solid improvement over the enjoyable but at times lackluster original. In the new video game released by PlayStation, DICE producer Craig McLeod spoke candidly about where, how, and why 2015's Battlefront ran into issues and how the sequel will improve on them. In essence, the feedback from fans was that 2015's Battlefront lacked the depth that some were looking for. One piece of common feedback that DICE received from fans was...
Yeah, they did yawn, just so you know. When they said it, they actually did yawn.
Yeah, I need air when I'm talking this long. We want more breath, literally, McLeod said in the view. So with the sequel, DICE and co-developers Motive and Cyterion are hoping to give players more ways to spend time with Battlefront and enjoy it. A lot of people found that with the original Battlefront, after a few months of play, they lacked long-term goals. So these are the things that are really trying to make sure we nail in this new game. Whereas the first Battlefront only had characters and content from the original Star Wars movies and later Rogue One, the sequel will have those along with prequel and new era. Key art for Battlefront 2 shows characters like Yoda, Rey, Darth Maul. Not only that, but Battlefront 2 has a more in-depth progression system to encourage players to spend more time in the game and give them a reason to keep playing. Another huge piece of Battlefront 2 is the single-player campaign. The first game didn't have one, but for the sequel, EA's Motive Studios is making a campaign that follows a new character named Idyn Viscero, a member of the Empire. Overall, McLeod said the level of ambition that Battlefront 2 has is something he never thought would be possible in gaming. The ambition here that we've managed to achieve is something I've never thought we would be able to realize when I worked at games. I am just incredibly proud of that. Battlefront 2 has big shoes to fill. As the original shipped 14 million copies to become one of the best-selling Star Wars games in history. The sequel launches in November, though you can play it ahead of that when the open beta begins in October on all platforms.
I'll buy it immediately if you can play a Gungan in the game. I can just imagine the trolls. Miss, I want to shoot you!
You know, Jar Jar was the one that really sounded like that. There was like a smarter Gungan that actually sounded... I'm like, can't we follow that guy? He sounds smart.
And one of them sounded like... Oh, damn, I forgot his name. He played Voltan in Flash Gordon. O'Brien Blessed. Me so no wanta, me boss nat.
You guys joke about that, but you do realize that that in the last DLC for the original Battlefront, they released, as a hero, not Lando Calrissian himself, but Lando Calrissian's, like, gimpy little partner, Yub Nub.
Not Yub Nub, I know who you're talking about, though, yes. I would have preferred they released Admiral Ackbar. Can you imagine all the players keep on streaming? It's a trap everywhere they went.
Ackbar would have been fun, yes.
It's a trap!
It's a frap. It's a rap.
And also, that bounty hunter that, Nien Nub, that was the one. I was close.
Yub Nub was the name of the song the Ewoks sung at the end of Return of the Jedi.
And then they released that bounty hunter that everybody always argues about whether Han Solo shot first or not.
Oh, you're talking about Greedo. Yeah, but here's the thing. You know, I really am disappointed they removed Yub Nub from, you know, I liked Yub Nub. It was happy. I mean, it was eminently hummable. Yub Nub, you know, I like that song. Damn it. It's part of my childhood.
All I'm saying is that you guys joke about Jar Jar Binks, but they've already released a meme and a co-pilot in the past. So,
well, here's the thing: you're going to be able to play as one of those stupid robots from the Phantom Menace. You know, Roger. Yeah, temporarily, by the way, because in the game in Battlefront 2, you can temporarily take over a robot. So one of them you can do is one of the palace droids.
That said, I am excited to see what they're doing with Battlefront 2, because at the very least, it sounds like they're listening to all the hatred people had for Battlefront 1.
And you know,
actually putting effort into it.
And I was the editor of one of the writers of the story, Mitchell Dyer, way back when Game Stooge existed. So yeah, one of my freelance writers just happened to go up the ladder and eventually became one of the writers for Star Trek Battlefront 2, and he's the one who's writing the campaign. I hope it has... Now, here's the thing about the single-player campaign. You play as an Imperial soldier, and you play from her perspective. And I'm hoping that it doesn't do the obvious thing and has her join the Rebels. I'd rather see her remain loyal to the Empire, even though she sees some terrible stuff being done. Sort of like, you know, my country, right or wrong sort of thing. Like the Imperial Auditor in the Old Republic. That's the kind of... Well, you can have them actually defect us. But, you know, the motivation is that, yeah, these are idiots who are running our thing. But, you know, I still believe in the Imperial because, you know, there's no crime where we are. That sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there are certain... The fact of the matter is, if you're going to have an army that big, then there has to be some sort of reason why all those people are in there, other than the idea that they might mostly be brainwashed people. But
oh, here's the thing. I don't think you have – only the Sith do Klingon promotions, you know. I can't believe that in order to get ahead in the Imperial Army, you have to kill your superior officer.
Yeah.
And
but I think you're right. It would be interesting to see a more – in-depth sort of, yeah, we've seen like we've seen Empire characters and seen a little bit of what the Empire military life is like, but we've never gotten like a character that like came from the family, joined the Empire, had their reasons from the get-go for being a part of that. It's always like a character that's like already maybe like a year into it, and it's like, I don't know if I want to do this anymore.
Yeah, you're talking about Finn now. I mean, we still don't know why. I mean, there's actually a rumor that Finn is actually a clone. Or actually, Poe Dameron's a clone, too. Which is why he keeps on coming back. Oh, yeah, that one died, but I'm the other one.
Yeah.
There was a comic book in which these two characters explained away all the plot holes in the Star Wars universe and why things happened. And there's just these two schlubs who, you know, I forgot the name of it, Big and Pink or something like that. Big and Pink. Anyways, but it actually is hilarious because the reason why there's a lone little TIE fighter that's following the Millennium Falcon is because those two are trying to get their attention because they're rebel officers. So Scott, you didn't play the Battlefront, did you?
No, I did not.
Okay. Would a single-player campaign convince you? I mean, it's like you don't have to deal with hundreds of other players. You can just play the story.
I guess I have to see. I mean, is it like a first-person shooting game? I mean, a third-person? I don't know. I got Jedi Knight Outcast if I want to do that.
You know, that's what Red Box is for, you know? just Red Box it, play the campaign, then return it.
I don't think I'll be buying this game. I mean, I hope other people enjoy it and buy it. And like I said, I mean, I'm glad to the fandom that getting feedback and trying to improve. That's always good.
And you know, if this Star Wars game is successful, you know, you'll see other ones. They had one Star Wars 4X game, which was horrible, which I hated. But I wouldn't mind it if they tried it a little harder the next time to do one.
Yeah.
So now I know you played the multiplayer of the first one, TJ. And was it sort of like, yeah, I've seen this map already, bored now?
It was like to the point where there were really only two to three different. It felt like there were only really two to three different maps for any given area until the DLC came out and added a little bit more. But the fact of the matter is, it just felt like what map you were playing was based on the game mode, and it really didn't change that much between game modes. There was the obvious ones. There was Hoth, Tatooine, Naboo, and I think
the forest planet, Endor.
Yeah, and Endor. And it really just like jumped between like either playing entire maps of those areas or small sections of those areas, depending on what game mode you're in.
It'll be interesting to see what they do with Heroes and Villains now. I would love to see like a 3-on-3. You pick your hero or villain, and you just go at it. Sort of like a Dota-style thing, you know?
Well, that's one of the things that they're doing with this one, is that they're getting rid of the tokens to get them, and instead you like have to raise up certain points until you like unlock the tier for that and get in there.
Oh no, I mean an entire game mode in which you actually play sort of like Rainbow Six Siege Star Wars.
Oh yeah, that would be fun.
Just having everybody's a specific character and they all have their special things.
Yeah, that would be pretty fun.
It reminds me of Yahtzee Croshaw's review in which he said, you know, and it was kind of fun to do the hero thing when you turn into a hero, but it always seemed like I would either become Leia or Solo or Han Solo, which were the most useless characters. Because, Han Solo has a gun. Whoop-dee-doo! And whatever it was that Leia's special power was.
Leia's special thing was she could pretty much one-shot troops in a hurry.
And that's it.
And she could lay down a special dome that would heal people that were inside of it.
Oh, isn't that sweet?
she's General Leia Organa. She has to lead the people. She has to be the driver.
We know what Leia people really wanted to play, and it involved a gold bikini.
they're never gonna get Slave Leia as a hero. And if they do,
they had it in Nintendo, for crying out loud. Anyways, we're gonna move on to the last item. I think I'll take this one, Scott. Okay. Moons of Madness is Lovecraftian horror on Mars, and this comes to us from Rock Paper Shotgun. Moons of Madness wants to be a lot of things: a Lovecraftian horror game set on Mars, a mature exploration of mental health issues, and a hard sci-fi space simulator. You're astronaut Shane Newart, who battled hallucinations to try and solve supernatural goings-on on the research station Trailblazer Alpha. From the looks of it, gameplay will be a mixture of the environmental puzzles, some of which will be very quote-unquote technical, and exploration-slash-spooky segments. Most of the focus on mental health will happen through hallucinations that combine Shane's memory of events that will happen to him in the future. According to developer Rock Pocket Games, quote, "These events bend the player's perception of reality by making them question what is a hallucination, what is real. Players can explore Shane's subconscious and discover background details of the characters in the game world. These events serve as both a foreshadowing and display the condition of Shane's faltering mental state. The game will feature a minimal HUD. All the information you need is projected onto the bottom of your helmet. If you're standing straight looking dead ahead, you can't see it, so you actually have to look down slightly to view your oxygen levels, inventory slots, and space suit pressure." So who wouldn't want to have a science fiction Lovecraft game?
This is at the very least original. I haven't seen a game where you're exploring another planet and suddenly you're walking. I mean, in the trailer, you get to see this guy, like, walking through caves, and suddenly he, like, has a hallucination that he's walking into his own home, and, there's this woman there, and he tries to turn her around, and something's messed up with her. And, like, at the very top of my head, I can't think of too many, like, planetary exploration / Silent Hill horror games.
You know, if it was done by the Chinese Room, I would be immediately getting it. It's Chinese Room, by the way, folks. Is it Don't Nod? Whoever did the Amnesia games.
Oh.
Is it the Chinese Room? No, the Chinese Room. Anyways. But you know what I mean. So, just so you know, it smacks a little bit of a walking simulator, although I think it's a little bit more involved than that. It's definitely a first-person adventure game. And I'm shocked they didn't announce a VR version of this.
I am too. It seems like it would be perfectly... Well, there's a thing about VR. With VR, you have to be a little bit careful because it often, like... The point of these games is to guide your eye towards where the quote-unquote scare is going to happen. And when you have the freedom of movement that you have with VR, that can be a little bit more difficult to pull off when you're just allowed to look at everything you feel like looking at.
Yeah, this game looks like a very brave and cool, you know, just use of the VR and bringing horror genre to a new level.
Like I said, you know, this is one of those games that could be actually really, really, really good or really, really, really terrible.
This game could be Dead Space 2, or it could be Dead Space 3.
Well, I hadn't played Dead Space 3, though.
Dead Space 2 was a masterpiece of horror.
The only thing I remember from Dead Space 2 is the very opening.
Yeah.
And I think it was because they were trying to up the opening of the first Dead Space, when everybody was raving about the Planet Cracker opening.
Well, the idea behind Dead Space 2 is that you've been taken to, like, a psych ward because Isaac Clarke, like, went insane for a while after losing his girlfriend. And seeing all the stuff he saw in the first game, which would give anyone nightmares.
Yeah, well, then the nightmares are up by the very first thing, in which you see an intern being attacked, killed, and transformed into one of the creatures right before your eyes, without the camera moving away. You see every second of this guy's torture and pain before he dies and is resurrected as a creature.
Yeah, and, That game, I want to say that game did it, came about as close as I've seen to doing like the whole psychological, but it was much more visceral. This is a much more psychological machine, and I think that's kind of cool.
This sort of reminds me a little bit of Solaris, and you know.
By the way, it was the Chinese Room that did that handled Amnesia Machine for Pigs and that Undersea game.
Soma. They did Soma.
Soma.
Yeah. I still haven't played Soma.
I've heard great things about it, but I haven't had a chance to play it either.
Actually, I actually have Bastion on Steam that I haven't played, but I already played it on the Xbox. So at some point, I'm going to play it again on Steam.
Did you say Bastion?
Bastion, yeah, because we were talking about Bastion earlier. It's like, oh, I have it on Steam, but I haven't played it on Steam yet. You know, I have the Xbox version someplace.
Have you ever played through the Xbox version?
Yeah, almost all the way through, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
As a matter of fact, I think it's backwards compatible. I think it's still. I think it's on my Xbox One if I want to download it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you ever get a chance to play Pyre, definitely take it. It's well worth it. Transistor 2, Supergiant Games, all good.
I heard Transistor was good, but not on the level of Bastion.
I disagree, but that's just me. There were a lot of things you could do with Transistor that I really liked. You could basically take different elements of like spells and put them together to create new spells, and I really enjoyed how much you could customize with that.
I'm going to shock both of you now. You know what two games I haven't played yet? I haven't played Cave Story, and I haven't played Undertale.
Oh, Cave was really good.
Same with Undertale. And that's the kind of game where, like, I don't know. If you followed like everything everybody's saying about it, then it's probably been spoiled.
I haven't really. But it's, I do know that you can play the entire game talking your way out of fights.
Yeah, if you haven't heard much about it, jump into it blind. Just go in there. Don't read up on it.
Oh, you know what game I did read up a little bit, and it spoiled for me. Do you know that game in which you're supposed to be shooting ducks or something like that? And then it just goes into just strange places, like you go down the rabbit hole. It's like all of a sudden all this stuff happens. It's like what? I thought this was just it was a frog multiplier or frog was it frog math or something like that? You know that game that's pretending to be an educational game in which you're doing a multiplication game with frogs, and then suddenly it starts just going in weird directions out of nowhere.
That sounds insane. I've never heard of that.
Oh, God, I just ruined it for you. I mean, play it anyway. I'm trying to remember what it was called, a frog multiplier or something like that. I'm looking it up right now. But it is just Frog Fractions. That's the name of the game. The original Frog Fraction is just bizarre. It is like okay, this is sort of like having a light little... It's sort of like playing a Disney game and then all of a sudden being face-to-face with the Slender Man. That's not what happens in it, but it's sort of like... And you know what? Here's the thing. The game I mentioned, Cave Story and Frog Fractions, and I don't know if it's true of Undertale or not, but they were all made by a single person on their, you know... And usually it's those games that are made by a single person, and I guess we can include Stardew Valley in there, that are always the most interesting because you only have one voice and one mind. Oh, yeah, and you can also say that about the Stanley Parable.
You can also sort of say that about all of the Five Nights at Freddy's series. Just one person did all of those.
By the way, the Five Nights at Freddy's RPG. And this is something that I wish everybody would notice. It was a mess. It was broken. It was unplayable, right? So the guy who made it said, you know what? Okay, everybody give me back your money. I'll give you back all your money, and I'm going to release it for free. And then he fixed it, and he kept it free. So he had a fully functioning, working RPG that he gave away for free because the one that he initially did screwed up. Mm-hmm. How often do you hear something like that?
There's obviously a guy that cares a lot about his product and what he's built with it. I mean, yeah. I mean, the Five Nights at Freddy's series, call it simplistic, call it like just like a patterns game or whatever, but he still went through the effort of creating five games in which he built these patterns, programmed these actions, and then created several different, like, created all the art for that too.
Okay, so let me describe to you Frog Factions for a moment. Frog Factions begins with a frog sitting on a lily pad. The player controls the frog and must use its tongue to attack insects while collecting and building fruit to do fractions. The game then later introduces upgrades that the player may purchase, including lock-on targeting, a cybernetic brain, and a flying dragon. When the player collects enough fruit, they can buy a warp drive, which allows them to ride their dragon through an asteroid field to bug Mars, where the player then battles an alien robot squid, and so on and so forth, and it gets weirder and weirder and weirder. It even includes a text adventure section.
That is absurd.
And it actually has a fake ending. And then you do a music simulator game, and it just goes on and on and on and on. And I'm sorry for spoiling it, but I spoiled it for myself a long time ago, so... And you didn't even know about it, but, like, it's a Flash game. You definitely should try it, just because it's just weird. And they did a sequel, but the unfortunate thing is that once you do that one joke, it doesn't work no matter how creative you are in the next one, because everybody is expecting, oh, this is going to get nuts. Just waiting for when it's going to get nuts.
Yeah.
It has to be one of those zeitgeist things, which Cave Story was. I mean, Cave Story was a free Flash game, and no one expected it to be anything except it was really deep. And I would almost say it's like a predecessor to Minecraft. Not in the building thing, but more like, oh, wait a minute, you can do that too? Oh, wait a minute, you can do that too? Oh, wait a minute, you can do that too? You know, the unexpected depth of a game where you said, oh, well, this isn't exactly as shallow as I thought it would be. As a matter of fact, it's pretty deep. It's one of those games.
I mean, it's like... Look at Serious Sam. The clear point of Serious Sam was always to be about, like, a brutal, in-your-face, edgy shooter.
Well, here's the thing. Whenever you think of Serious Sam, you think of those headless guys with bombs for hands that scream.
Yeah. And once you get past that in the first game... You just kind of expected it going forward, and it's not really surprising so much as they can up the ante, but you're kind of just expecting them to at that point.
You know, the last Serious Sam game that was released actually played with subversions in which it started out as a regular military shooter, just a bore, a drawing bore, and it's like, okay, so they went, and then all of a sudden you're back to the guy screaming with bombs for hands.
The one interesting thing that I've heard out of a Serious Sam game that, like, caught my attention in a while was the piracy protection they did on the last one.
Oh, yeah.
In which if you pirated the game, a security protection came into play, and that after a certain point, a pink scorpion a scorpion man would come after you. And he was unkillable and would chase you through the entire game until you died.
Which some people actually found as a feature and not a bug. Because they inadvertently made a roguelike. So, you know, there's a question for you, Scott. What game did you play that you thought would be okay, but it turned out to be a lot more deep than you thought it could be? And don't say Minecraft.
You still with us, Scott?
He just turned on his mic. Okay, while Scott is thinking, I'll tell you mine. Seven Cities of Gold. I thought it was going to be, oh yeah, it's just some exploration game, in, you know, and it's going to be like, oh yeah, you meet Indians in the New World on you. But no, it turned out to be really, really deep, much deeper than I thought it would be. How about you, Scott?
What's the question?
What game did you play not knowing how deep it would really get, that it was a lot deeper than you thought it was? Okay, well, let's pitch this over to TJ while Scott thinks. How about you, TJ?
ActRaiser. I just thought it was going to be a straight-up platforming game, and I think that was because I played ActRaiser 2 before I played ActRaiser 1, which was pretty much a straight-up platforming game. But ActRaiser 1 has sim qualities. You basically play as, for lack of better terms, God. And you were the idea is that you were defeated by Satan a long time ago, and in your absence, you basically went to sleep to regain your power. And in your absence, Satan has taken over the world, and all of humanity has lost faith in you. So you start the game by rebuilding cities and shrines, and communicating with humanity and helping them defend against demons and all these different sim elements. And then once you've gained enough followers and enough people believe in you again, then you do platforming levels. And I thought that was really, really cool. And that's why it's one of my favorite games of all time.
I like that game as well. I thought that was a really good concept, combining city management and platforming.
Yeah, it's on the original Super Nintendo, Jonah. It was one of those games that I've brought up over and over again about the Super Nintendo Mini and how they should have put a game like that on there.
You know, the one game that would have been it for me had I not already known would be Spelunky when it comes to platformers. I already knew from word of mouth that it was actually a really deep game, but had I seen just the box or the screenshots and all that, I said, oh, okay, it's a platformer like Lode Runner or Boulder Dash.
I think for me, the game that surprised me on depth was Final Fantasy VI, where you're going through the adventure, and then halfway through it, the world ends, and it's just totally ruined by the villain, and now you have to deal with that and be in that world, the world of ruin. And I think that really surprised me at the time, because I didn't think a game would do that. Would be like, we're going to destroy the world. Now you have to live in that world, as opposed to, because usually you stop that sort of thing from happening. But then,
I think it's more in the plot twist area, though. That's sort of like, oh God, I don't want. The plot twist from Jade Empire. And you know the thing is that the plot twist from Jade Empire is so good, I still refuse to say what it is. Because it's set up so beautifully. But anyways, that's the question of the week. What game did you play that had surprising depth? That you thought it was just going to be some shallow thing? Oh, yeah. But then all of a sudden you say, wait a moment. There's actually more to this. You know, there's some. We can go to the obvious one, and that's Minecraft. Because here's the thing, Scott. When you first played Minecraft, did you know anything about it?
Yeah, I saw a game version that they did was Race for the Wall, and basically you have to go. They built these levels mirrored to each other, and you have to go through and collect the pieces of wool, and then complete the monument, and then you win that level. So I did have an idea, but it just, as the years gone by, it has amazed me how many things people can do with this game. So I guess in a way it has, surprised me, because people, you play anything now with this, all sorts of different PvPs. You can do racing on horseback or elytra. There's game shows. There's just the limit is your imagination.
And the funny thing is that Minecraft started an entire new genre. The blocky crafting game.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's like people didn't realize how much they could do. Oh, well, okay, I'm going to chop down the tree. Oh, wait, I can build a pick. Oh, wait, I can build a house. Oh, wait, there's things coming out. Oh, I better build the fences. Oh, look, I can build a moat. Oh, look, I can build a conveyor belt. Oh, look, I can, they kept on going on and on and on and on and on and on and on until someone built an actual functioning working cell phone in the game.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's the question of the week. I don't know what else to say. Oh, yeah, look for our show at a gaming podcast .net, along with industry news and our gaming history articles. We enjoy feedback, so leave us comments on our blog at gamingpodcast.net. Also, sub at facebook.com/gamingpodcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us on iTunes comments. So, I think I was going to ask, what games are you looking forward to? Is there anything you're looking forward to?
Dragon Quest XI.
Okay. I mean, that's coming out soon.
Not sure. I don't know if anything's coming out soon.
How about you, TJ?
Off the top of my head, I guess I'm really interested in... I'm interested in Sonic Mania, if only because I was a Sega kid, I had a Genesis. I'm happy to see them finally going back to this style of game, and it's looking like they... It's basically it's a fan project that Sega took note of and were like, okay, well, let's put some resources behind this and let this guy run with it.
But here's the thing. It actually takes the original levels like Green Hills and all that stuff and twists everything in each level. So it's sort of like, oh, wait, that's new.
Yeah. So it's built with so much love, and I have so much love for those original games, so I'm really looking forward to playing
them. Well, guess what? It's been getting rave reviews, including Jim Sterling, who gave it a 9.5, so... And also, they also created new music for it, too.
Yeah, and music was also one of my favorite parts of the original games, so... I'm really excited to see how that soundtrack's going to go.
Oh, you know what? That reminds me. Anybody who's interested, do a YouTube search for Michael Jackson in Sonic 3. And there's a long story that was suspected about it, and now a lot of things have been revealed about it. And it's a whole long discussion of what happened with it. Because a lot of the music in Sonic 3 was actually composed by Michael Jackson. And his other, and a lot of people who worked with him. As a matter of fact, one future song that was the end credits for Sonic 3 was actually used for a later song by Michael Jackson. It has to be weird. You know, you played Sonic 3, you played to the end, you hear the theme music, and all of a sudden, a couple of months later, a music video comes out, and wait a minute, that's the ending to Sonic 3. What the hell's going on here? Anyways, we will see you next week.
Happy gaming, everyone.
Take care, y'all.